Okay, the clock on my computer says 3:02, so I think we will get started. This is Tim Brennan. I'm Treasurer and Chief Financial Officer of the Unitarian Universalist Association and a member of the Investment Committee. We're all here today for our quarterly UU Common Endowment Fund Investor Call. And on the phone with me are Kathleen Gaffney, who is the Chair of the UUA Investment Committee, and David Stewart, who is a member of the committee and also the co-chair of the UUA Socially Responsible Investment Committee. So today, we are going to go over the performance review. Kathleen will present that. We'll also talk about the August 31st Investment Committee meeting and the actions that the committee took at that time. David is going to give us a quick briefing on the actions the UUA has taken with regard to the fossil fuel divestment resolution of 2014, and then we'll open up the line to your questions and answers. And right now I have the line on mute for everybody except our speakers. I will open it up later on. If you pre-registered for the call, Susan Helbert would have sent you the presentation, and you can follow along. If you did not pre-register, you can go to our website, uucef.org. That's uucef.org. It stands for UU Common Endowment Fund.org. And over in the right column, about halfway down, you'll see a link that says View September Investor Call Materials. And if you click on that, you can see the PowerPoint presentation that we will be using during this presentation. So I think with that, I will turn it over to Kathleen Gaffney, the chair of our investment committee. Thanks, Kathleen.
Great. Thanks, Tim. So everyone, welcome to the call. And I'm going to start with the performance review, which begins on page 3 of the materials. We're going to be looking at our total returns versus our peer universe. So our peer universe being other endowment funds in the size of $50 million to $250 million. I do have some good news today. For our near-term results, the most recent quarter, year-to-date, and the fiscal year-to-date, we have very solid returns. What you're seeing for the most recent quarter is a return of 4.3%, which ranks us in the second percentile, so really strong performance relative to other endowments. Year to date, we have returns of 10.1, ranked also second percentile. And then fiscal year to date, a 14.9% return in the first quartile. So significant change in performance over this near-term period. I would say this is really attributable more to our philosophy of sticking to active management, less about any significant changes in the portfolio. And really, we've been patient with our best long-term performers, and we've seen them rebound, and we've continued to have a strong focus on traditional active management. Looking to the medium-term performance in the middle of the graph there, you'll see the 3- and 5-year period returns are below median, and I would attribute most of that performance to the recent market environment where active management has been less in favor, and the markets have been supported by strong liquidity from the central banks, and it hasn't taken a lot of effort to realize market-based returns. However, I do want to point out that our long-term track record, looking at 7 and 10 years, backs up that traditional focus on active management, where our 7-year return is about median at just over 8%, and our 10-year is at the top of the second quartile with a return of 5.4%. So pleased with the performance that you're seeing across the near term and long term, and very comfortable with our current positioning. If you look at page 4, you can get a sense of what the calendar year returns have been over the last 10 years. And I think this supports what I said about the detraction from active management in recent years. If you look at our returns from 2012 through 2016, it's been tough to keep up, mainly because the market has been focused on reaching for yield and, again, supported by very easy stimulative markets. I think the track record that you see for the fund going back to 2007, and particularly 2008, where we did have a down year, but very good downside protection, and then rebounded significantly by sticking with the managers that we trust through years 2009 and 2010, which were very strong years. And I do attribute that to the active management. So we have done some, we have had some changes within the portfolio. I think over the last few calls, I've mentioned our completion of the fixed income allocation review, and we have been looking at some newer mandates, and I'll address those if we now turn to page 5, where you'll get a look at first performance through July 31st, so an additional month there, and July continued to show strong performance with a finish of 12.7% for the fund. Net of fees. Gross of fees, it was 13.8. And that 12.7 outperformed both the allocation index and the policy index. So that is a reflection of our manager selection. I know this is a lot of numbers on page 5, so what I want to highlight is about two-thirds over to the right, the one-year performance, as well as the second to the last column, the return since inception for the fund and for each manager. And what I would point out is that our ability for the composite overall to outperform occurred with most all of our traditional categories, equity, domestic and international, and then as we'll see on page 6, fixed income. So on the domestic equity side, our managers in aggregate returned 16.8% versus the Russell 3000 at 16.1. The strong performance coming from our second equity manager, domestic equity manager, Sands, who had been lagging but has also been a long-term performer. You'll note that the one-year return at 23.7 handily outpaced the benchmark of 18.1. But more importantly, in my mind, the long-term since inception for this manager is 11.4 annually, versus a benchmark of 9.1. So again, the value of sticking with your long-term active managers. For an underperformer, I would highlight the Wellington SMID-CAP manager, which is a fairly new manager. We have a little over 1 year of performance. Their inception was April of 16. And while they're underperforming, we like to give our managers a chance to get through a cycle. We believe that we have a strong due diligence process, and so we're keeping an eye on this performance, but are comfortable with that. And you can see with four equity managers, the diversification there allows us to be patient investors. I will highlight that Rumline is one of our ESG managers. They are more benchmark-like and have a very competitive fee, but fit with our UU principles. And so I think that's an excellent example of working with those principles and delivering on strong returns. For the international equity managers, the 1 year returns were 19.8 versus the benchmark of 19% for the MSCI ACWI. So these are international equity managers. I would highlight the strong returns coming from MFS, 23.2 versus the benchmark of 17.8, and also a strong performance from one of our newer managers, Baxter Street, an international all-cap growth high active share manager at 19.7. versus the benchmark of 19%. Again, a diversified stable of managers with Boston Common representing an ESG category, an ESG manager delivering strong returns as well. So fitting with our investment objective and principles. Turning to page six, taking a look at the fixed income performance, strong returns in what has been a fairly challenging market for returns in fixed income, with interest rates backing up initially but then settling back down, netting out to essentially a small negative return for the benchmark, the U.S. Ag. Our fixed income managers in aggregate delivered a 3.7% return, and if you look at the far right, delivering good market returns over the long run for just 4.6 versus 4.5.
Hey, Kathleen, this is Tim.
Yep.
This might be an opportunity to just review quickly what the committee has done to restructure fixed income. Because if you look at the report, you'll see for a lot of these managers, it basically blanks all the way along except for the most recent period. And that's because we've reshuffled the fixed income in light of current interest rate trends.
That's a great point, Tim. So when we did our fixed income allocation review, our concern was that the fixed income component was overweighted towards more interest rate sensitive traditional fixed income product. And what we've done is we've reshaped the fixed income so that we do have some high quality, low cost downside protection through the Breckenridge Treasury allocation. That is the fifth manager in the fixed income roster. And as you can see, while it is short-term performance, essentially meeting market returns, which is exactly what our expectation is, Breckenridge also does a higher quality corporate fixed income portfolio for us that does focus on ESG, and that also produces higher quality index-like returns. So those are the two components that are more interest rate sensitive and traditional fixed income, and that represents a little over 7% of the total endowment allocation. The other three managers that you see, the first one, two, three, are Brandywine, which is a higher quality top-down global fixed income strategy, followed by Loomis Multisector, which is more credit-oriented, so taking more credit risk, including below investment grade, emerging market, and non-dollar bonds, and that is 5% of the total endowment fund. And then Franklin Templeton, which is also a very opportunistic global fixed income manager that takes high active share but is well-regarded and well-known for their country selection across the world bond markets. The last item is Lumisail Strategic Alpha. We have reduced our exposure to Strategic Alpha, which is more of a low-vol fixed income strategy, and moved it into the multi-sector to increase our overall total returns. We continue to have, for the moment, about a 2% position in Lumisail Strategic Alpha, and are looking to move out of that for a more opportunistic investment in the future when one that we think is appropriate is presented to us. So I think of our structure for fixed income currently as being the 7% in traditional fixed income, which gives us some anchor to windward when markets are more volatile. And then as we move into what we expect to be a more volatile, more challenging return environment as interest rates move up, using three very different opportunistic fixed income managers, Brandywine, Loomis Multisector, and Franklin Templeton. And that represents 13% of the total endowment. So 13 to 7 is the split there, and fixed income is 20% of our total allocation in the endowment fund. I think this is a strategy that will serve us well for the long term. And performance-wise, even though these are short-term numbers, we are seeing a positive effect. I would highlight that while it is very, very short-term, Franklin Templeton at a slight negative is underperforming, while the other managers are market returns or better. And I would highlight that Franklin Templeton, recognizing that volatility, is a small component of the overall allocation in fixed income. So moving on from fixed income, looking at our opportunistic investments, this is primarily two managers. GMO, which is a global tactical asset allocation, has produced some positive returns this year, 9.4%, which is better than one of their two benchmarks, which is CPI plus 5%. This is a manager that has struggled with performance, but also goes under a very different strategy, where they should do well if we get a real risk-off upset in the markets. They're holding a lot of cash, and they're positioned for a risk-off environment. And given the returns, we're still being patient with this manager, though watching them closely. Sevian Capital is a European hedge fund focused on European equities. They have delivered very strong returns in a relatively short period of time. So achieving exactly what we would expect is high returns, and we are accepting some volatility over the long term with an opportunistic strategy like this. Those are our opportunistic investments. Think of them less as a commitment to outright hedge funds and more to very high active share managers who have a specific expertise that we think will add return and help to diversify the fund. On page 7, we finish up the performance review with our private markets. So these are less liquid, more closely aligned with private equity, where you can get very attractive returns in the long run. And while this is a small allocation due to the lack of liquidity, because of our long time horizon, we view this as a very attractive asset class. Those investments are with FEG Private Opportunities Fund, which we inherited, and then two relatively new investments, Brockton Capital, which focuses on the European property market, and then SJF Ventures, which is a positive impact strategy that focuses on clean energy and efficient and sustainable investments. So something that we think is attractive, particularly with our objectives as well as our UU principles. We also continue to have 1% of the endowment fund committed to community development, and the cash position is currently just below 1%. So a good rebound in investment, and I think a positioning that will suit us well for the future. Just to reiterate the highlights of performance on page 8, the second quarter of 2017, 4.3% gross of fees in the second percentile. The trailing 1 year, 14.9%, top quartile, close to top decile. And then the 10-year time period, at the top of the second quartile. The previous rolling 1 year, ending July 31st, up 12.7. So I'm very pleased with the efforts of the staff and the committee and the focus that we've had on the fund. I'm going to now talk about what we discussed at the most recent investment committee, and we're definitely putting in a quick turnaround with this quarter's call. We just met on Thursday of last week, so given the long weekend, a lot of this is still, fortunately, fresh in my mind. It was a really productive meeting. As I have talked about on previous calls, this year has been very much a focus about integrating the two investment committees, the investment committee and the socially responsible investment committee. We've made progress this year. We've moved forward by preparing our agendas together, and both committees are now meeting on the same day. So there's an overlap to our agenda where we all meet together. And Thursday's meeting was the second time we had the joint meeting. We also, during this meeting, took a next step by having two subgroups present ways for us to continue to integrate the two committees. First, we were looking at the specific responsibilities and taking a hard look at the separate investment policy and guidelines that you can find in a variety of different documents govern the Common Endowment Fund. And our purpose in looking at all the documents and comparing the authority and the responsibilities that each committee has is it really allowed us to bring greater clarity to what our objectives are, both separately with our individual committees, but also where we do have common ground, because that is really, I think, the key towards our complete integration. And we did find some common ground, particularly with how we think about what our objective is. And there are two objectives. And what I found very useful in the meeting was identifying that with two objectives, you still can uphold your responsibilities as well as your fiduciary duty. And Tim had gotten a legal opinion for all of us to discuss at the meeting that relates to how our principles, our UU principles, allow us to still uphold what is our objective to deliver strong performance, to be able to deliver strong investment returns, and that's why we communicate our performance relative to our peers. Our peers don't necessarily use the same constraints or principles that we do want to employ. And I think that was a really terrific discussion for all of us. And in particular, what I would highlight is that the Common Endowment Fund is regulated under jargony acronym. It's called UPMIFA, which is the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act. And that's where it allows us to consider that a duty of loyalty to our principles as well as what we need to uphold investor expectations and returns. So I think that really frees us up to look closer at our specific responsibilities. What we acknowledged at the meeting is that the Socially Responsible Investment Committee has responsibility to advise and assist, and their advice and assistance is directed to the investment committee in regards to screening and manager selection to uphold our values. It's to assist the UUA staff, and it's also to advise the UUA board. So those are the specific responsibilities, whereas the investment committee is authorized to make investment decisions, but both committees are held by our UUA values. And that's where the overlap is, and that is where our next steps will take us, which is to make sure that we have specific responsibilities for each committee spelled out, hopefully in one document eventually, but then also to very clearly and consistently define the hurdles for what lives up to our UUA values. So I think this gives us some very clear movement towards that integration, and I think we all are energized and enthused about the productivity of the meeting and where this is taking us together and with each committee separately. I was really very pleased with that. That's all I have to say on the integration. I'm going to turn it over to David to talk about the business resolution.
Thank you, Kathleen. Continuing on with the business resolution, we've been as has been our practice over the years since that resolution, we've been slowly removing those Carbon Tracker 200, which has now been renamed Carbon Underground 200. Fossil fuel companies that we no longer do resolutions or dialogues with. We hold a few of these in small amounts in our advocacy portfolio, although we still have a handful of these companies in our normal portfolio. Several of them, including Chesapeake, Pioneer, Whiting, we've fallen below the minimum amount to even be able to actually engage with them to file resolutions or to be a significant enough of a shareholder to ask for a dialogue. So we're this last meeting, we basically decided to either move all of these remaining small amounts to the advocacy portfolio, which is to say an aside account that is purposely held only for the purpose of creating a dialogue with the company or to be able to file a shareholder resolution, or to remove these companies from our advocacy and or normal portfolio altogether. So from here on out, all of our remaining CU200 holdings will not be held, will either, you know, have been reduced to nothing or will be held in our advocacy portfolio from here on out. So that will show up in our future reports to General Assembly by being able to directly address the comments that the intent of those folks who wanted complete divestment that we're going to have in all cases.
So David, can I just jump in? This is Tim.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah. So, but then there are also the companies which I don't think you've touched on yet. There are several companies where we have full holdings within the portfolio, and those are the companies where we're directly engaged with them either through filing resolutions or through dialogues or other kinds of engagement. And that is all detailed in the report we submitted to the General Assembly, which I would recommend, if you're interested, any of the investors on this call, take a look at that report, because it really does go into pretty specific detail about what's going on with each company, and not just what the UUA is doing, but what we are doing in cooperation with the Ceres Network, the Investor Group on Climate Change, and the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility.
So we on the SRI committee feel very satisfied with our continued progress with regard to the 2014 Fossil Fuel Divestment Resolution, and as well as our commitments to continue the resolutions that we've done and the dialogues that we've done. We feel like we've had excellent success that I don't think we probably really have time to go into at the moment, but Tim is quite right to be proud of what we've done. And as well, I would encourage anyone who would like to see the excellent work that we've done, check out that report. Yeah.
Yeah, this is Tim again. I'm just glancing at our UUCF website, and I see that we have not posted that report here. It's posted on the GA web pages, but we'll put a link on this page to make it easy for folks to find it.
And Tim, I would even suggest, since we have everyone's email that's on this call, that just email it out. If they don't want to read it, they don't need to, but at least they have it easily that way.
Great. What we'll do is, we'll email out a link to the report. Yeah, that's a terrific idea. So, Susan, remind me. David, was there more you wanted to touch on?
No, just to say that, you know, we're quite happy with where we're headed to integrating the two committees. The fact is that the whole goal of setting up the two separate committees initially was because the state of the industry was really not where it is today. And we feel like the industry has changed, and while the EUA is still leading at the cutting edge about how we handle SRI issues, we're quite satisfied that the investment committee fully has you know, taken into account SRI concerns whenever possible, whenever managing their fiduciary duty as well. So this integration makes sense. It doesn't imply that the SRI role has significantly changed as much as it implies that the tools of the trade have changed, and that we're cleaning up kind of the way the two committees interact and you know, what the roles and responsibilities are. So, yes.
Great. Thanks a lot, David. Kathleen, did you want to say anything about the small cap manager search?
Since we just met on Thursday, it's more of a, I guess it's really more of a housekeeping issue. We did make a decision that we wanted to replace Peer Capital. So we interviewed two managers. We are close to making a decision regarding one, but still have some checks that we want to complete before we make that official. But that was the work that we completed on Thursday, is to interview those two managers. And I just want to thank David for his comments. I do think it's a terrific direction that we're all moving in. And that's it for me.
Yeah, okay, good. And just one more word on the small cap manager search. I mean, this is one of the benefits we get for being a client of New England Pension Consultants. What Kathleen just mentioned is the very end of the process, but NEPC did a broad search of small cap managers, brought us a book with several options, all of which they came highly recommended. The committee looked at that, narrowed it down to two firms, and those firms we interviewed last Thursday. And as Kathleen said, we're in the process of making a decision. But NEPC has a very deep research bench. They have about 60 people who work just on the research side. And this enables us to really get quality managers into the portfolio. So I think that's all good. So I think we're now at the point in the call where we're going to want to...
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
Everybody is now muted, but if you press *6 on your phone, it will open up your line and you can ask a question. So so go ahead. If you have a question, press *6.
Yeah, this is Bill Connors.
This is Jim Eagle at UU Santa Fe, a member of the Permanent Endowment Committee and an investor. And I just wanted to thank you guys.
Okay, Jim, you're second in line. I think we have one question before yours, then we'll go to you. Just stay on. Okay,
sure.
Back to you, Mr. Connors.
This is back to me, Bill?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Bill Connors. I'm with First Universalist Church of Denver, and by way of disclosure, I'm a 30-year investment advisor. So I had, going back to the very top here, when you talked about your gross fees versus your net, it looks to me like the annual fee is about 2.2%. Is that accurate?
No, it's just over 1%.
Okay, so well, if we come up to now, I'll find the slide here in a second. Fund commentary. It says over the trailing 1-year period, the endowment rank returned 14.9 gross, and then later down it says.
Yeah, it's a different period. So that net comment is for July.
So it's,
and the other ones were for so if you look at slide 5, you can see if you look at the difference between the top blue line, which is composite, and the next blue line down, which is net, the difference is on here it's 1.1%.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. And is New England's fee included in that? Is that all fees?
Everything is included. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes. So so it's not a fee. I mean, it's not.
Oh, sure. Of course.
Not charging 1.1%. It's actually an accumulation of all the underlying costs. So the
right.
fees for managers range from about 12 basis points for our benchmark large cap equity, which is Rumline, up to like 1.6% for some of these more specialized strategies.
No, that makes good sense. I got
all,
it. No problem.
Blended. Yep.
Yeah, I just misread that summary. When I look at the, and I've got a couple questions, but they'll be quick. When I look at the analysis of the fixed income, of course, it's kind of hard to see how you get to the 3.7. I still didn't quite understand why the individual management company returns weren't in there. You know what I mean? The benchmark numbers were in there, but the individual ones aren't.
We didn't actually hold them during those periods. So what it's showing is the actual returns we had for that piece of the portfolio, but the elements were different. So there were other managers that we had in the and allocations that we had within fixed income. This schedule is actually prepared by NEPC for us, and to try to put it all in and somehow pull it all together would be incredibly complicated and difficult to understand. So what we show are just the current managers that we hold, but there were different managers and different allocations in the past.
Yeah, well, 3.7 is a pretty good number. It seems like I don't think I would have replaced them. I mean, I'm not second guessing.
Well, it was more. I'll let Kathleen respond to that, but I think it's what we would say is it's more forward-looking. So the interest rate environment is changing. It's maybe becoming more risky, and we think this lineup really provides us protection against shifting interest rates in the future. And
so one question is
exposure.
Can you give a hint about how much of that fixed income is non-U.S.?
Sure. The Brandywine Global and the Franklin Templeton are both non-U.S. managers. So that is the majority of the non-U.S. The Loomis Multisector is going to have a portion of it that will change over time that may be invested in non-U.S. Countries or companies, but it tends to be a relatively small component of it. So I think if you just look at Brandywine and Franklin, you'll get a good sense of what the non-U.S. exposure is.
Yeah, well, Templeton's probably global, but anyway, that's just so one last question. You made reference to this FEG that you inherited, but that does that mean that you inherited it, but you made a conscious decision to keep them? I mean, that just seemed like a funny comment.
Tim, will you help me out on that? Was I correct in saying that?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. So there was a an endowed fund separate from the UUA but dedicated to supporting the UUA called the Liberal Religious Charitable Society. They decided to close and to turn over all their assets to the UUA. When they did that, we liquidated everything and then just incorporated it into the regular strategy and asset allocation, with the exception of this FEG fund. It's a private equity fund, so it can't be liquidated. I mean, it could be, but we'd incur a big penalty to do it. So we felt like the most prudent thing was just to hang on to it for its life. But we're not adding to it, but we're going to hold it until maturity because we felt like it was just there was no good reason to take a penalty to get out of it.
Sure, I get it. Okay, so two quick questions. So the investment committee is in charge of either hiring or firing the managers, is that correct?
Yes.
And how about the allocation?
Same thing. They're in charge
okay.
of the allocation.
All right. Thank you very much from Denver. That's all I have.
Okay, good. So I think Santa Fe, you were on the line?
Yes, this is Jim Eagle from UUC Santa Fe, and I'm a member of the Permanent Endowment Committee. And we're in the process of moving, actually, to the UUCEF, our endowment fund. It should happen this month, I hope. But I would just like to thank you guys for being so transparent about sharing the real difficulties and frustrations associated with having two investment objectives. As an individual investor, you know, I am facing the same issues, and as somebody's trying to help an institution do investment, it's the same problems, and you're providing real guidelines for us, and so I just want to thank you for it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. That really means
thank
a
you.
Lot, and that's why we want to be transparent. It's because we realize this is not just a struggle for us, but for many others. So it's great to be able to do it with your support.
You're very, very welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, we're really proud of it as well. This is David. We're really proud of it as well because we can pull a lot of the best minds across the UA into this effort as well as using NEPC to help. So it's really the effort we're able to do, we are very proud of.
Tim?
Yeah.
Now, this is Ward Kelsey calling from Pittsburgh. I guess I want to, first of all, say, since we've been drawing down our account like crazy to do some major capital stuff, that I really appreciate the fact that we've had a place, because we've been very lucky or unlucky, but we've inherited a fair amount of money from some long-term members over the last few years, and we've been able to have an easy place to put it and watch it carefully grow, and it has made things much easier for us around the church. If someday, if it ever gets hot again in Pittsburgh, you can come out and enjoy our air-conditioned sanctuary. But having said all that, I did want to say or ask this question, and this is me being the market climbing a wall of worry, I guess. I am very pleased with the results that we've been showing recently for the fund and also for my own investments. But I also do wonder if this is just, to a large extent, a rising tide phenomenon. And if it is, what do people think is the possibility or the likelihood of the fund taking a beating if the tide starts to go back out?
Kathleen, that's a good question for you.
Well, I understand your sense of caution, and clearly that is on all of our minds as well. While I highlighted the one-year returns and how strong they are, I don't think they're outsized returns, so I think it's part of the success of our long-term asset allocation that we do with NEPC. I would not be surprised to see some sort of a give back in the markets at some point. This
right.
has been a long run. But we are not market timers. And the other reason I highlighted the very long-term returns, and particularly the downside protection in 2008, is
right.
that by knowing your managers well and sticking with the ones that you have confidence in for a long period of time, it's the strength of your asset allocation, and I think our philosophy gearing it towards active managers that will serve us well. And I will also say it's the discipline of staff in keeping that allocation rebalanced, which they do. So I have a lot of confidence for those reasons that even if we do get some volatility, which would not be surprising at all, for the long term, we're well positioned.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll climb down my wall a little bit.
I understand. I understand.
Yeah, so, Ward, I would also comment that, you know, you framed it as a rising tide, and it's definitely true. It's been a rising tide. Most, you know, markets have been very favorable, but just as Kathleen said when she started off, you know, we're outperforming the rising tide.
Right.
We're at the top of the tide. So, So that's important. And then I think the other thing, which, again, Kathleen said it, but I'll come back to it, is that when everything's going up, you know, it's the active managers tend to underperform. When things get more volatile, that's when your active managers start to pay off. And
right.
We've already been seeing that over the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're, although, you know, we may see a downturn, it's quite likely at some point, but we're well positioned with our portfolio to withstand that and not take the brunt of it. The folks who are all rushing into these large cap equity index funds, I think, are going to meet with an unpleasant surprise when the markets inevitably turn.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Tim. I appreciate it.
So we got a couple more minutes. Another question? *6 to unmute your phone. Okay. Remarkably quiet group today. Usually people have tons of questions. So I think maybe we'll just end it there, and I will thank Kathleen very much for presenting and David for being on the call and presenting. We really appreciate everybody's confidence in the fund, and I look forward to talking to you again. If in the interim you ever have a question, feel free to contact me directly or contact Susan Helbert here in the office. We're always happy to talk to our congregations that are giving us their confidence. We really appreciate that. So with that,
Tim?
Yeah?
Tim, I apologize. It took me a few minutes to figure out how to get off mute. I do have a question if you've got another minute
okay,
here.
Okay, sure. No, go ahead, please.
So my name is Alan Brooks. I'm with one of the trustees at the First Parish Unitarian Universalist of Northborough, Massachusetts. And back in 2014, I was pretty involved with our congregation in the discussions of fossil fuel divestment. I will say that my opinion at the time was that the congregation should not adopt that as an investment policy. That turned out not to be the way the congregation went. But my question for you guys who follow the investing world pretty closely is what seems to be happening overall with respect to fossil fuel divestment over the past few years? Do you see that as still something that is very active, that there's a lot of funds that are moving in that direction? Do you see it as something that's kind of fallen by the wayside? What's your sense of what's going on there?
I'll give you my view on it, and I don't know, maybe David will have a thought or Kathleen, but in the world that I travel in, or that we travel in, which is institutional investors who are concerned about climate change, and that's through a group called CERES, C-E-R-E-S, CERES.org, if you want to take a look at their website, and then through the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, which includes most of the major faith groups where we collaborate on different issues, including climate change. I'm not seeing much energy around divestment in either of those groups. If you look at the 350.org website, you'll see a lot of organizations listed as being part of the divestment movement, including the UUA. But most of those have actually, approached this with caution. I mean, for instance, Stanford is listed, and what they did was to get rid of coal companies. United Church of Christ, which set up a separate common endowment without fossil fuels, and that's attracted about 5% of their assets. Meanwhile, the pension funds have not moved in that direction. So I think there was a certain statement made through the fossil fuel divestment movement, and I will tell you, because we do sit down with these companies and their managements, that they felt that, and there was a bit of sting to it. They're not happy about being, you know, viewed as, you know, societal pariahs. So it may have, you know, provided a little extra push to them. But I think that the key point I would make is that it's been very important for active shareholders and faith-based investors to be at the table, you know, directly speaking to these companies, making the case for action on climate. And we've seen significant movement from these companies. It's outlined in that report. We're going to circulate the link to that report. I encourage you to look at that. But I think it's been, I don't hear a lot as much about it as I did a few years ago. Maybe that's where to leave it.
Okay, really appreciate that summary.
Yeah, and this is David. I could add a quick thought to, I think some of the real, Sturm und Drang, whatever the, you know, the real angst about that has seemed to die off a fair bit. I also think that seeing, for instance, BlackRock and some of the other large mutual fund type investors come off the sidelines and really start engaging and voting their proxies has underscored not only the importance of climate change as something that investors need to do something about, rather than say they just simply don't vote their shares, that sort of thing. It has underscored how important it is to large investors and folks that are behind those folks that handle that money. I think that it was important to get that PR recognition that some of that divestment talk did lead into things that that may have an ultimately more productive outcome. I think the success we've had at Exxon, the success that we've had in uncoupling CEO compensation with new drilling, and then the other piece is just the simple economics of petroleum is driving some of the kind of realizations of these companies. I mean, you've seen the CEO of Shell lately say the next car and every other car he'll buy after that will be electric, and various other things like that. So I think we're going to see a lot of movement in the clean trillion and other places like that, to where I don't think the main movement forward is going to be via divestment. I think it's going to be, you know, solutions that are hashed out, folks getting their hands dirty and working out deals with them, that sort of thing. Anyway, that's my thought on it.
Yeah, and the last thing David said is, I think, important, which is that there's been a huge amount of activity on positive investments. And, Kathleen mentioned SJF Ventures, and that's what they do is, you know, they're putting private equity into climate change solutions. So I think we're going to see more of that. So with all that, I think we've kind of used up our time.
Is there time for one last question?
Well, we have 30 seconds, so go ahead.
Okay, it went on a bit there. I've been waiting. Basically, we've been extolling active managers. My question is, are any of the active managers in the equity arena actually prepared to either get out or go short a portion of their portfolio in the case of a downturn? This is Doug Diamond, by the way, from San Diego, First UU.
Yeah, our equity managers are all long only. So, they have different strategies. The active, you know, Sands is our large cap equity growth manager, and they are investing in companies that they think are going to deliver value even in a downturn. So that's their approach. But they're not moving to cash, and they're not going short because that's not their mandate. Other parts of our portfolio kind of address that. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to say, Kathleen, on that.
No, that's exactly it. It's their philosophy and strategy that we believe will get them through. I think I did mention that GMO is prepared for a more risk-off market, as we understand from current positioning, and they do have a fair amount of cash, I believe.
Yeah.
And that's what you'd expect with a more opportunistic strategy, is to be take that view and have be ready to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So we're
my most successful mutual
portfolio.
My most successful mutual funds have been, has particularly one, is over the long term been willing to go to cash when they see a downturn coming, and that's the most effective protection. And it's hard to see it, but all I'm saying is it sounds to me like it might be useful to have that kind of active manager in the mix.
Yes, and we do through GMO. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay, everybody. Thanks so much for being on the call. Again, if you have other questions or want to continue the conversation, please reach out to me or Susan Helbert, and we'll talk to you in 3 months. Thanks.